The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The UN's Human Rights Council recently held its 50th session. One of the side events was entitled World Drug Day 2022, presenting UN human rights experts' call to align drug policies with human rights. We're going to hear from some of the speakers. But first, the California State Assembly has approved legislation to allow supervised consumption sites in a few jurisdictions for a very limited time. This is a tiny little baby step in the right direction. Under SB 57, only four jurisdictions in California will be allowed to decide whether they want to allow the establishment of a supervised consumption site. There are a lot of restrictions. It's only a temporary pilot project scheduled to end at the beginning of 2028. The vote was June 30th. Here's Assemblymember Matt Haney.
Members, I rise to present Senate Bill 57 on behalf of Senator Wiener. San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Oakland, the cities included in this bill, are in the midst of a terrible, horrific, escalating public health epidemic. In the last 2 years alone, over 1,500 people have died of opioid overdoses in San Francisco. That is nearly twice the number that died of COVID-19. Many have died in public, on our streets, parks, and benches. I have personally witnessed people die on the sidewalk in front of my apartment in the Tenderloin. These are people with families, friends, and loved ones, and futures needlessly cut short, lost forever to a death that was preventable. This drug overdose epidemic is devastating families, communities, and hurting our state's recovery. That's why this bill is so important. First and foremost, there is no doubt that it will save lives by stopping overdose deaths and keeping people alive. It does that by giving some of the areas most affected by the opioid crisis, San Francisco, LA City, LA County, and Oakland, the discretion to authorize overdose prevention programs known as safe consumption sites. To be clear, no city or county is required to establish an overdose program under this legislation. Instead, SB 57 only authorizes cities and counties to decide locally whether or not to participate in this pilot program. This is a local control bill, and each of the four participating jurisdictions have requested to be included in this legislation. Unanimous votes by LA County Board of Supervisors, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Oakland City County, and a 14-1 vote by the LA City Council. This is a proven intervention that works. Approximately 170 overdose prevention programs exist in over 14 countries, including now in other states. They've been rigorously researched and have been proven to make neighborhoods safe. Overdose prevention programs bring the opioid crisis and drug use off our streets and parks and out of people's doorsteps. They save lives by allowing people to use controlled substances under the supervision of staff trained to prevent and treat overdoses. These sites also stop the spread of HIV and hepatitis by having clean supplies on hand, and most importantly, provide testing to make sure that drugs that might be laced with deadly fentanyl that is killing people in our state are stopped. Staff on site can connect people with services, healthcare, and treatment to get people off drugs altogether. Healthcare organizations are supporting this bill because overdose prevention serves as a point of entry to get people suffering from addiction into detox and drug treatment and on the road to recovery. I know most of us would prefer that people just don't use drugs at all and they seek treatment, but addiction is an illness, and we have to reach people wherever and however we can with interventions, and we cannot help someone seek treatment when they are no longer breathing. Overdose prevention programs not only save lives, but they save taxpayer money as well. They reduce the burden on services like ambulances and emergency rooms that traditionally respond and are increasingly overwhelmed by overdoses. Studies have shown that criminal activity actually decreased rather than increased in the areas around overdose prevention programs. This bill also ensures that law enforcement and public health officials have a seat at the table, requiring a public health hearing, a public hearing with input from law enforcement, public health, and general public in advance of authorization. This is also a pilot program. It sunsets in 6 years, and participating jurisdictions will be required to produce a peer-reviewed study analyzing the site's performance. This will save lives. People are using drugs currently. There is nothing about this that encourages drug use. If you look at the data, if you look at our streets, we need to pursue much more aggressive health and medical interventions, safety interventions, and we cannot keep using the same tools and expecting a different result. Our cities are begging to be given the tools and the authority we need to confront this crisis at the local level with an epidemic that is killing our residents. There is tremendous urgency and we are ready to act. Respectfully, we need this body to give us that authority. And with that, members, I respectfully ask for your aye vote.
That was California Assemblymember Matt Haney speaking before the California State Assembly on June 30th in support of SB 57, the short title, Controlled Substances Overdose Prevention Program. The Assembly approved the measure that day by a vote of 42 in favor to 29 opposed, with 9 Assembly members not voting. The measure now goes back to the State Senate in order for that body to agree to the amendments made in the Assembly. After concurrence, the bill goes to the governor. The longer this process takes, the more people will die. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Support Don't Punish Global Day of Action was June 26th, coinciding with the UN's World Drug Day. World Drug Day 2022, presenting UN human rights experts' call to align drug policies with human rights, was the title of a side event held June 27th at the 50th session of the UN's Human Rights Council. One of the speakers was Alina Steinert, member of the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention.
As you already alluded to, and as I'm sure the learned audience is well aware of, in July 2021, so nearly just about a year ago, the working group concluded and presented to the Human Rights Council its study on arbitrary detention and drug policies. This is a significant piece of work that was undertaken by the working group at the request of the Human Rights Council. This request, dating back to 2019, in the view of the working group, really was a tangible acknowledgement by the Human Rights Council of it taking note of the work of the working group on issues concerning the negative impact of drug policies upon the right to personal liberty over the past 3 decades of the working group's mandate. Consequently, this study follows previous concerns raised by the working group in its numerous reports to the Human Rights Council about the increasing and, in some cases, systematic instances of arbitrary detention as a consequence of drug control laws and policies worldwide. The working group has also previously expressed concern about the frequent use of various forms of administrative detention imposed to control people who use drugs, often framed as a health intervention, which may lead to involuntary commitment or compulsory drug treatment, in turn leading to arbitrary deprivation of liberty. Through this study, we therefore strive to provide further guidance to states and other stakeholders on practical measures to prohibit and indeed prevent arbitrary arrest and detention in the context of drug policies. Because let us not forget, the prohibition of arbitrary detention is absolute. There are no reasons that can justify it. There are no circumstances that can legitimize it. It is a right to personal liberty, that belongs to absolutely every human being. There are no exceptions. Throughout our work in the study, the working group notes the punitive drug controls and policies continue to be used in many states, despite being ineffective in reducing drug trafficking or addressing non-medical drug use and supply. Such policies have resulted in the increasing use of arbitrary detention in the context of drug control, with people who use drugs being particularly at risk of arbitrary detention. From the perspective of the working group, failure to address the health concerns, which are at the heart of the issue, but rather treat drugs issue through criminal justice measures solely, fails to uphold the fundamental tenet of international human rights law, that personal liberty is the principle, and any form of detention must be an exception to that principle. What we have observed and what we note in the study is that the so-called war on drugs has resulted in further increase in detention and imprisonment for drug-related offences, as well as numerous human rights violations and disproportionate sentences for drug-related offences, often accompanied by a ban on parole or amnesty or those convicted for drug-related offences in some jurisdictions. Through its work, the working group also found that despite the evidence in terms of lack of effectiveness of compulsory treatment the practice of confining people who use or are suspected of using drugs against their will in state-run or in private compulsory drug treatment centers is still widespread and can and does give rise to arbitrary deprivation of liberty. Similarly, courts often coerce defendants with a choice between imprisonment and drug treatment. In the view of the working group, the shift from punitive to supportive approach should be translated into making drug treatment voluntary and based on informed consent. Really and truly, as the United Nations System Common Position on Drugs Policy has emphasized, drug use and dependency should not be treated as a criminal matter, but rather as a health issue to be addressed through rights-based measures, including public health, education, the provision of mental hygiene treatment, care and support, rehabilitation and transition and reintegration programs. Dear colleagues, as you know, working group is only one of the special procedures of the Human Rights Council. There are some 45 thematic mandates and 13 country mandates currently with the Human Rights Council. It's quite a considerable number indeed. And as the working group was working on its study on arbitrary detention and drug policies, as we were examining our own jurisprudence and work on this topic, we also noticed a significant crossover with so many other mandates. And there are no surprises here, really, if one reflects on the profound impact that the drug policies adopted by some states, and more importantly, their implementation in practice, has upon people's lives in every aspect. Such policies have far-reaching negative implications for the widest range of human rights, including the right to personal liberty that I already spoke to, freedom from forced labor, from ill treatment and torture, fair trial rights, the right to health, including palliative care and treatment, right to adequate housing, freedom from discrimination, right to clean and healthy environment, right to culture and freedoms of expression, religion, assembly and association, and right to equal treatment before the law, just to name actually the few. These policies, many of which are gender blind, have also had a profound negative impact on the world's most vulnerable people, including minorities, people of African descent, indigenous peoples, children and young people, persons with disabilities, older persons, and so on. And my learned colleagues will speak to that in more detail. But there is more than just direct negative effect on people and their individual rights. The forced eradication of crops in the context of drug control policies can lead to loss of life due to excessive use of force by security forces. Aerial spraying of hazardous substances used to kill illegal crops can and does cause serious harm to the environment, subsistence harvest, and clean and safe water, as well as the health, economic, and financial independence and welfare and well-being of Indigenous peoples and peasant communities, especially women. So the aim of the statement really is to galvanize the attention of the world of the truly profound effect that current approach towards drug policies have and just how detrimental this is to the whole catalogue of human rights. This simply cannot go on. And so, in this statement, the working group, together with a dozen other thematic and country special procedure mandate holders, urge member states and international bodies to supersede their current drug policies with ones grounded in the principles of the application of a comprehensive, restorative, reintegrative justice approach. Effective, community-based, inclusive preventive measures are equally important. Now, more than ever, the international community must replace punishment with support and promote policies that respect, protect, and fulfill the rights of all communities.
That was Alina Steinert, member of the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear from Judy Chang, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs.
So the real crux of the problems faced by women who use drugs is really driven by the collision of the war on drugs and gender inequality. Women who use drugs, we face double stigma for not conforming to gender norms, and we're judged more harshly for drug use and drug dependency than men, as we're cast as putting our own needs and the pursuit of pleasure above gendered roles of caring for others. But the impacts of drug prohibition and structural patriarchy have real serious and life-threatening implications, and they include impeding our right to health. Women who use drugs have higher HIV and hepatitis C prevalence, not only because there is a serious lack of harm reduction services, let alone gender-sensitive harm reduction services, but because of this overarching and overall controlling and patriarchal medical system, which we understandably avoid because of stigma and discrimination. In many instances, we're turned away from health services and treated as second-class citizens. So the sexual and reproductive health rights of women who use drugs are also routinely suspended because society doesn't deem us as fit parents. Drug use during pregnancy is specifically criminalized in some countries, and others allow by law forced abortion and termination of parental rights of women who use drugs. So a second, you know, key right that is commonly violated is also the right to be free from arbitrary detention. So we have harsh drug laws that are coupled with patriarchal norms and assumptions, and they lead to the mass incarceration of women who use and inject drugs. In many parts of the world, women who use drugs are more likely than men to be incarcerated for the same offence or face harsher sentencing laws. And this is particularly the case amongst Black, Indigenous women and women of colour. Another right commonly suspended is the right to be free from violence. Many of us have experienced gender-based violence, both from law enforcement and intimate partners. And this violence happens with impunity. Because we are criminalized, we are always viewed as flawed victims and have our words doubted. Our rights to proper legal redress and protective mechanisms are restricted or non-existent. For example, many domestic violence shelters often deny women who use drugs entry based on the sole criterion of drug use alone. Finally, the right to non-discrimination and participation is denied. Criminalization and state-mandated punishment unequivocally drives stigma and discrimination, as we are labeled as deviant, out of control, and incapable of knowing our own minds. So the only rational response to such a situation is to focus on movement building. And this happens amongst women who use drugs in various forms, through networks, movements, and also organizing concepts such as narcofeminism, which, like all feminist movements, are really like at their key about recognizing the agency, self-determination, and right to make decisions about our own body as women. Women who use and inject drugs, especially women of colour, you know, we live in a world designed really to shame and break us down. But despite this, you know, there is shows of resilience and working in solidarity. I think we all know that we are very far from where we need to be, and it's really, you know, key time, high time for women who use drugs to also be seen as, you know, being able to lead in responses and being meaningfully involved and directly participate in the policies and programs and practices that affect our lives. So it's only in the last few years that IMPUD and other national networks of people who use drugs have been engaging in these human rights mechanisms, even though, of course, since our inception, we've seen using the rhetoric of human rights and the practices as important to give shape and definition to the inequalities, violence, and aggressions that we experience as a community. Of course, there's always been a strong interest from the community in utilizing human rights mechanisms, despite their complexity and the fact that, you know, often they're not always easy for lay people to engage in. But we want to use them because human rights mechanisms can be used to hold governments accountable. And it's, you know, one of the tools to be able to fight back against authoritarian governments but also in our case, you know, governments the world over who ignore, attack, and punish people who use drugs. So I think in this context especially, there is a need to push the human rights agenda and narrative more strongly than ever before, as we all see, you know, this growing anti-rights lobby. Of course, we do have discussions with community that engaging in these processes really do take time, effort, and resources, that they're not, you know, always there for rapid action, but it's more about norm setting and building cases. But it is, of course, critical at this point in time that we bring human rights to bear on drug policy and really use the arsenal of human rights mechanisms to fight back and demand that we should be treated as any other human being. So I think two of the most prominent examples of people who use drugs engaging in human rights mechanisms actually have both come from the Eastern Europe and Central Asia region. So first was Kermanayevsky et al. Versus Russia. And this is when three drug user activists took the Russian Federation to the European Court of Human Rights challenging the state's, you know, continual ban on methadone. Unfortunately, this was not successful. But then in 2018, Asteria, who are a women who use drugs-led organization in Kyrgyzstan, you know, they came together with other women from key populations, so sex workers, transgender women, as well as women living with HIV, to submit a shadow report to the 81st session of the CEDAW. So I think really significantly, the CEDAW recommendations on Kyrgyzstan referenced women who use drugs several times and called for the removal of criminalizing laws. Also in 2022, the drug user-led networks in Pakistan and Burundi are also looking to engage in the UPR process. So, you know, what we have found from our experience and their experience in engaging in human rights mechanisms is that there is a need for capacity building, specifically for community-led networks. You know, we know that it can be a very complex ecosystem of human rights. And, you know, currently there is under-resourcing of community-led networks to engage, despite holding the most knowledge and expertise on the lived impacts of laws and policies. So just coming to the statement, of course, it's a critical statement. It provides additional leverage to our advocacy. It's very significant that all the special procedures have put their collective weight in calling for an end to the war on drugs. I think, you know, we also need to look at going beyond replacing criminal frameworks with health and rehabilitation, you know, without having a more in-depth analysis, because also health settings, you know, we should also remember, can be experienced as punitive and controlling. They're not always neutral spaces. So what is important for us as a community and key is using a social justice lens. You know, we aren't always just passive recipients or victims, but are people with agency and the right to political participation. We intersect and are in solidarity with many of the marginalized communities listed in the statement. And of course, there's intersectionality across sex workers, LGBTI communities, Black, Indigenous people of color, women living with HIV, and more. But it is about more than vulnerability. You know, it's about fighting active, intentional oppression. And their struggles, just as much as ours, depend on, you know, the fact that no group of oppressed people who have experienced inequality ever really attained liberation without the involvement of those directly affected.
That was Judy Chang, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs, speaking at a side event at the 50th session of the UN's Human Rights Council entitled World Drug Day 2022, presenting UN human rights experts' call to align drug policies with human rights. Let's hear now from Melissa Opreti, Chairperson of the UN Working Group on Discrimination Against Women and Girls.
I think what we have seen as a mandate is, you know, pretty much reflected in the joint statement. And as alluded to by previous panelists, we do see that the war on drugs involves a host of punitive laws and policies. many of which are gender blind and really do contribute to a range of human rights violations that are yet to be fully recognized and addressed. We have found that although women comprise around 7% of the worldwide prison population, 35% of them have been convicted for a drug-related offense compared to around 20% of men. So the proportion of women in prison for drug-related offenses is far higher in some countries, particularly across the Americas and Asia, ranging from around 45% to over 80%. So consequently, one of the most concerning implications of the war on drugs that we have seen is that there has been an increase in the female prisoner population, particularly in certain parts of the world, despite their often low-level, non-violent, and first-time involvement in such crimes. Women appear to be more exposed to the risk of being caught and prosecuted as drug carriers. And they are also often disproportionately punished, which was also noted by one of the previous speakers. So in terms of what we've done in this area, in 2018, we submitted a thematic report to the Human Rights Council, which looked at the different pathways for the deprivation of liberty of women. And as you know, based on the information that we received and what we learned through the process, we did include the issue of women's incarceration for drug offenses in our analysis, because this really stood out. And what we saw, among other things, is that the global war on drugs has had very serious human rights implications, but the gendered impact is neglected. And this is mainly due to, I mean, what we think is that it's mainly due to the harmful sex and gender-based stereotypes of women, which are fostered by deeply entrenched power imbalances and inequalities. The current approach of the international system of drug control, with its dependence on law enforcement and criminal sanctions, simply does not acknowledge the various realities of drug use, dependence, and trafficking, as well as, most importantly, I think, the pre-existing vulnerabilities and risk factors of women, which are linked to a range of factors, including their sex, gender, class, and race. So the punitive approach to drug use has also had a ripple effect that is felt by women in situations of great vulnerability, namely even pregnant women and new mothers. And this is reflected in the practice in some countries. And we have found this during some of our country visits, that the practice of drug testing new mothers and newborns, which has led to children being forcibly taken from their mothers and put in a broken foster care system. And racial bias is very evident in these cases, and these policies typically target low-income women. We've also observed, shockingly enough, even during some of our country visits, the inhumane practice of shackling pregnant women who are under incarceration for drug use during childbirth. And this is in complete violation of their rights as prisoners, and also has implications for a range of rights. So what we have found is that women's pathways to drug-related offenses are often gendered, that socioeconomic marginalization, poverty, the lack of or fewer job opportunities, and the absence of social protection from the state that would allow women to meet their most basic needs and support their families. And even in the context of interpersonal relationships and private relationships, their involvement with men who use drugs are often key factors, but these are neglected. In addition, women's experiences of administration of justice as well as imprisonment are gendered. Many cannot afford legal counseling. They face gender stereotyping, and there are expectations that women should be better behaved.
That was Melissa Upreti, chairperson of the UN Working Group on Discrimination Against Women and Girls, speaking at a side event entitled World Drug Day 2022, presenting UN human rights experts' call to align drug policies with human rights, which was held at the 50th session of the UN's Human Rights Council. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now,
for the Drug Truth Network,
this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.